From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. President Trump has fired National Security Advisor John Bolton. An hour ago, the president tweeted he disagreed strongly with many of Bolton's suggestions, as did others in the administration. The most widely reported recent disagreement appeared to be over the president's plan to meet Taliban leaders at Camp David. We'll have the latest right after the news. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. Later this hour, a program matching homeless young adult Angelenos with residents willing to provide an extra bedroom. We'll hear from the program's director and a host who had a young couple living with her for a few months. But first, President Trump announced on Twitter an hour ago he's fired National Security Advisor John Bolton. With us to get more details, Daniel Lipman, White House reporter for Political. Daniel, thank you for joining us. We'd heard reports there was some tension between the two men, but what have you been able to glean about the timing of this?
Yeah, so, I'm hearing that there's been a lot of disagreements building over the last couple of weeks and months. Bolton was more of an interventionist, and he wanted to keep the U.S. entangled into Afghanistan and other countries. He didn't want talks with the Iranian president, Rouhani, that Trump wants to meet with, and also this the Taliban meeting at Camp David that raised big concerns on his end because he didn't think that it was a right thing to do, and Trump eventually canceled it, but was not happy that Bolton was trying to prevent him from doing that.
The president in his tweet indicated other members of his administration disagreed with the ideas that Bolton presented. What's your sense of the accuracy of that depiction?
Well, you know, Bolton did not get along with Pompeo for months, and they had ongoing feuds, and they were leaking against each other. They just have a different philosophy on foreign affairs. Bolton is, you know, he sticks to his principles and is not going to change them just because of who's in power. And Pompeo is more hewing to whatever Trump wants. And so it's not good to have a Secretary of State who is clashing with the National Security Advisor all the time.
All right. The president said that he fired Bolton. Bolton says he resigned. Does that matter?
Well, it matters because it sets a narrative of, you know, who gets to win on the actual in the history books, basically. Bolton wants to make it look like he resigned and he wasn't forced to go. And Trump wants to set his own narrative, which is totally contrary to that. And so this is a long running pattern in that Trump likes to fire people via tweet and does not like to let them resign. And so, you know, it's kind of not uncommon that this would have happened. I'm not surprised.
Who now, without Bolton, what are the members of the national security team who presumably are talking with the president regularly about U.S. strategic interests?
I think we have Secretary of State Pompeo. We have Mark Esper, who's the defense secretary. You know, there's some deputy national security advisors, but they're not big names as much. But it's kind of bare bones there. And, you know, we have, they're kind of going to announce a new national security advisor next week. And so we haven't really seen the candidates yet, but it'll determine whether the U.S. continues to try to draw down from conflicts like Afghanistan, or do we, get a national security advisor who wants to keep us involved.
Daniel, I was surprised when John Bolton was chosen for this position because I think of him as a hawk, and Trump, it's a little less clear where he stands, but certainly he talks as being much less interventionist than Bolton does. What's your sense of the challenge of finding a successor to Bolton? There have been four national security advisors during the president's term, someone who's going to be more aligned with the president.
Yeah, this has been, Mike Flynn, who was Trump's first national security advisor, only lasted less than 3 weeks in the job because he had lied to the FBI and all that. And so it's really interesting to see how much turnover there is. And that hurts the policy process on the national security stage because, you know, it's good to have continuity and it's good to have people all in aligned, although you don't want to have groupthink. But, you know, this is something that is very, you know, troubling in terms of having a cohesive policy coming out of the U.S. Government.
Does this have any effect on the negotiations with China over trade and tariffs? Because the president frames this as being an issue of national security as well as economics. Could this have an effect?
It doesn't seem like that is a huge, if that's a huge thing, because the national security, the strict national security stuff was more prominent instead of the trade stuff. And so Bolton is kind of focused more on that and the conflicts instead of the, economic stuff.
Daniel, good to talk with you. I know you're on a tight deadline. Thank you for joining us. We appreciate it. Daniel Lipman, White House reporter for Politico on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up, we'll talk about a recently established program that links young adults who are homeless in Los Angeles County with households willing to take them in because they have an extra bedroom, an available bathroom, a kitchen that can be used to help transition young adults from their unstable housing situation into something that is more permanent. We'll talk about that coming up just a minute on Air Talk. Wonderful to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up a little bit later this hour, a new report that a number of apps that track menstrual cycles are sharing private health information with Facebook. And we're talking with privacy advocates and others about opt-outs that are available, as well as some of the apps that say they're changing their practices as a result. But first, we turn our attention to a new Los Angeles County program that seeks to link up young adults who are homeless, 18 to 25 years of age, with households that have an extra available bedroom, a bathroom that's available, and the ability to use a kitchen so that those young adults can transition from being unhoused to hopefully longer-term housing. Joining us to talk about it is Annabelle Gurwitch, who's been a frequent guest with us on Air Talk, actor, comedian, writer, who wrote in the Los Angeles Times about being a host for a young couple who stayed in the extra bedroom of her home, and Allison Hurst, the founder and executive director of Safe Place for Youth, the nonprofit which has set up the Host Home program. It just launched this year. Allison, let me start with you first of all. Thank you so much for coming in. How many hosts have taken part in the program so far?
So far, we have piloted the program and now fully launched the program. And 11 young people have been hosted by 10 hosts, or 9 hosts. So 11 young people have been hosted so far.
And this is temporary. It's about 3 months. Is that the design?
The design is short-term bridge housing, bridging from the street to a more longer-term housing opportunity. But it differs greatly from host to host. So some people have stayed just for a few weeks, and some up to, I think we have one person who's being hosted now who may stay longer, more up to 6 months.
And how do you go through the process of matching the hosts with the young people who need a place to live?
Oh, it's a pretty extensive matching process, and Annabelle can speak more to that because she's actually gone through the process. But there's an extensive training, and then we're really looking at how to identify ways to connect people in a more meaningful and deep way. So if somebody is particularly creative or a writer, then we potentially will connect somebody with somebody who is interested in that field. Or if somebody has a particular religious affiliation, maybe we'll connect somebody that way. So it varies enormously, but we're trying to create more of a deeper connection other than just two
that
humans.
They sleep there, so that there'd be kind of a more emotional support, potentially.
Absolutely.
I'd love to hear from you as an AirTalk listener. If you have questions about this program and think it might be something you'd be interested in, we're at 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722. Maybe you're someone also who came through the foster program when you were a young person and you found yourself in challenging circumstances when you hit 18, 19 years of age. Maybe you want to share from your experience if something like this would have been helpful to bridge that experience of living on your own. 866-893-5722. Or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Annabelle, good to have you with us.
Oh, thanks, Larry. I have to tell you, if I had known that this program was in its nascent launching, I probably wouldn't have volunteered.
You wouldn't want to be the guinea pig for the opening.
I didn't realize that I was one of the first hosts. But it really opened up my mind and changed the way I see people. And, I now like to use that term, experiencing homelessness. Because I think when you say homeless, that can seem to define people in a way that is very limiting to how you see them.
What was the experience like for you going through this training process? What were the things you felt you had to learn before you'd be ready to host?
Well, first of all, I'm an empty nester. So I do have, my kid is in college now. And so I felt like I actually would be when I realized that I could do this hosting, that I have this extra bedroom. But I have a great love for this constituency, for people this age, for young people. And so, I felt comfortable that in being with a young person. I also, my kid is 2.5 years into recovery from drug and alcohol addiction. So I had some experience with, therapeutic environments. But there was a sensitivity training. And, blew my mind. I didn't even think about how we converse with people that could be triggering. Like when I meet someone, I might say, what do your parents do? Where are you from? Not thinking about the fact that that could be
a lot of traumatic stories behind that.
Also just like, what are you doing today? Might sound like you should be looking for a job. You should be doing this or that.
And share with us the young couple that came to live with you, how that worked out. Did you feel you were able to provide sort of more holistic experience than just renting the room?
I didn't know what to expect. And when they arrived at my house, one of the things that initially just, was so devastating to me was when they said they were calling their parents, this idea that they had parents, for some reason, I kind of thought, people who are unhoused fall from the sky. I don't know.
You think of them as disconnected.
Right. And I immediately just felt they were just like all the other young people that have come through my home, friends, peers of my child's. And, I tried to give them their space. I really didn't want them to feel they owed me anything, but we very quickly fell into, routines of eating together and of talking sometimes late at night. And it was just so much more comfortable. With every interaction, I realized that I had so many otherizations that weren't appropriate.
How long were they with you?
They were with me for a month. And, we had some differences. And this is one of the things I felt was so great about SPY was that they provided a lot of leadership in helping you understand what your role is as a host. And everyone who's hosted defines it slightly differently. Like my house guests joined a church. I happen to be a big atheist, and I wanted to be very careful, not to try to influence them to, bring them over to my atheism. I wanted to respect that. So I would leave Anne Lamott books for them. So, I wanted to just encourage
capital
them.
A atheism.
Yes.
We'll continue with Annabelle Gurwitch. We're talking about Safe Place for Youth's host home program. The founder and executive director of Safe Place for Youth, Allison Hurst, is with us as well. Love to hear your questions, your thoughts about this program, which matches young people who need a place to live, bridge housing that can last 3 months, in some cases longer, with a host able to provide a bedroom, access to a bathroom, access to a kitchen. We're at 866-893-KPECC. Back in 1 minute. Wonderful to have you with us on Air Talk. We're talking about the Safe Place for Youth's Host Home Program, nonprofit organization which has this up and running this year, pairing hosts who have an available bedroom, access to a bathroom, access to a kitchen for someone between the age of 18 and 25 who doesn't have a place to live. This is intended to be short term, just a few months long, that the young person can get on his or her feet. And we're talking about some of the challenges involved, the potential successes. We're at 866-893-KPECC. Javier in Encino said, I did this on my own a decade ago. I'm a Christian. I want to help people as an expression of my faith. So I took in someone who was homeless, gave her temporary housing, paid for some of her medical care as well. That's Javier in Encino, 866-893-KPECC. Pepe writes on the page, I'd have a hard time opening my home to a complete stranger of any age who might be an alcoholic or drug addict who may bring in others. But that said, there's also the question of how, if it's not working out, you can get rid of the person without having to jump through a bunch of legal hoops. Allison, can you speak to that?
Yeah, so our team works really closely with the hosts. There is no point where a person is placed with a host and then left alone. They're in continuous contact all throughout the whole process. And there are regular check-ins, so there's always an opportunity to start kind of unpacking if there are challenges and whether maybe potentially it's not working out and maybe there's a respite host. We have some hosts who are fully committed and will take young people for long periods of times, and then we have other hosts who want to be a respite host and maybe take somebody for 1 or 2 weeks or even a few days. So there's always an opportunity to move somebody out.
So I assume that that the person who's living in the host's home, they don't have the same legal rights as the tenant because the stipend's being paid by your organization, not by the young person. So it's not like you have to go through eviction hoops. I would assume you're the sponsor, so it's up to you to handle if the host is no longer able to keep the person.
Absolutely. There's no contract, and there's no requirement. If it's not working out, we are very quick to move and make sure that it's working for everyone. We don't want anybody to be hosted in a place where they're not wanted, so we'll move very fast to find an alternative.
And what's the size of the stipend for the host?
It's $500. And so far...
Monthly.
Monthly. And so far, the majority of the hosts have taken some or a little bit of the stipend, but most have not wanted the stipend. But we think it's really important because I think there is such an untapped potential. There are so many spare bedrooms, and people could really do with that stipend to make it possible to host.
Sure, Annabelle, yeah.
You know, I wanted to mention one of the things that... SPY does and other host home programs are doing, which is that there is a lot of curation to this project. So we negotiated a contract, my house guests and I. So, you know, there were house rules. There were things that we all agreed upon. And it is kind of funny when you think about taking in a stranger, but it's also strange that people go on dates with people that they meet on the internet and they're hooking up with complete strangers. So when you really think about it that way.
They do usually go home, though. So in this case, your home is their home.
That is true. I mean, we you know, we did, we met several times. There was a process of matching that was, we really articulated our expectations. And I was always assured by SPY that should we not have an agreement, should there be any, you know, break in the communication, that, you know, we would end that. And I did, I'm going to say I did take the stipend.
Yeah.
I've been renting out my extra bedroom that used to be called the punishment room, where my ex-husband and I would sleep when we had arguments. And, but I'm that empty nester divorced person who, you know, is doing what a lot of people are doing, which is home sharing as a way to, you know,
to pay the mortgage.
Pay my mortgage. So that stipend did make it possible for me.
Yeah. And was it a very different experience having this young couple stay with you than the tenants you'd had in that bedroom?
You know, the funny thing is I've had mostly fantastic experiences, but, it, you know, with renting out the bedroom. But this was actually the most rewarding of all.
Did they go on to a permanent housing situation after they left your place, or do you know?
I do. I'm still in touch with them. And this is one of the questions people ask me, like, what is your obligation? What is the expectation there? And from what I've heard from other hosts, as well as my own experience, is that you design this experience yourself. How much you want to be part of their lives and community is up to you. I keep in touch with my house guests. I like to know, you know, how they're doing, but I also don't want them to feel obligated to I'm not their parents.
So where are they living now?
They are actually at another host home while they are saving money to afford their own household. You know, one of the things that you realize is, I mean, so many of us are transplants. I moved here. I was a transplant. People let me couch surf. I stayed with people's homes while I gathered the funds. I worked as a hostess at a restaurant when I first moved here. It's really hard to make money in the gig economy to be able to afford an apartment in LA. With the housing situation, it is so hard. So we're really just extending that community that so many of us, you know, had the opportunity to have done for us when we arrived here.
We asked a couple listener questions. Karen in Mid-City LA says, if the guest has mental health challenges, continued drug use, or displays behaviors that might make the host feel this is not compatible, can the host immediately terminate the agreement?
Yeah, so back to what I said before, it probably wouldn't be a very good match if somebody was experiencing some kind of level of mental health issues or addiction issues. And maybe if somebody was in recovery, we would put somebody who was interested in going into recovery with somebody. But it is not the right resource for somebody who has extreme mental health issues.
Well,
so we wouldn't be matching.
Yeah.
That was part of the contract that I had with my house guests, was there would be no use of illegal drugs or alcohol. We also, my contract was that we would have a no conflict zone in the house. That was very important to me, that the house be very calm. I mean, not to not be, you know, human, but that this was a place, a respite, you know.
You're the actor saying no drama in the house.
Yeah, exactly. Only my drama. No. So there we had, you know, rules in the house.
Where's the funding coming from for SPY?
So in the first year, we piloted through a grant through United Way of Los Angeles. And then this year, it's a fully funded program through Los Angeles Homeless Services Authority, so using public funding to launch. And four agencies have been funded to provide the service. And so we're at the very beginning of this. But I truly believe it has enormous potential. It so aligns with the philosophical approach that we have at our agency around creating relationships first. And so we know that there is a massive untapped empty bedroom market in this whole county. And this could be a very viable resource for all ages, not just young people, for young families, for seniors. You know, seniors and young people are the fastest, the folks that are falling into homelessness the fastest. So it is, it's a a community that we really want to match with this resource.
I'm not finding the link to it on our, is it on our AirTalk page? Maybe I'm just not seeing the link to the organization's page, Safe Place for Youth's host program. It's there. All right. I'm just missing it. So you'll see the link if you'd want like further information about the program. Let's talk with Justin, who joins us in Pasadena. Justin, you're on AirTalk.
Hi, Larry. Thanks. I just wanted to share my experience and also say how important I think programs like this are. So my son's friend, 13-year-old, we saw that his family was falling into experiencing homelessness, and we ended up taking in my son's friend for around 6 months, taking him to school every day. We had dinner at the dinner table. And we kind of went into that informally without any kind of support mechanisms. And I think programs like this can provide the kind of support that helps make that process easier and benefits everyone involved.
Justin, appreciate it. Thank you for sharing your experience. Yeah, I think there are a lot of people like yourself who do this with friends or family members, but sometimes that doesn't work out. And you know, I just think from my anecdotal experience talking with the people who don't have a place to live, that often they've stayed with family members or with friends, and it just people got burned out on that over a period of time, and they haven't found the permanent solution. So thanks for sharing. Yeah, real quickly, Annabelle.
You know, that actually happened to my family when I was growing up. We lost our house and income, and we lived with cousins, and my grandparents supported us. And for people who don't have that kind of support network, this is a way of providing that in our community. And I just wanted to say, I just feel like it's a very important time in our country and in our city to ask ourselves, who do we consider our community, and how can we be more inclusive?
Annabelle, thanks very much. Appreciate you sharing your experience as one of the hosts for the Safe Place for Youth's Host Home Program. Allison Hurst, the founder and executive director of the nonprofit. Thank you for joining us, talking about it, Allison.
I'm really delighted to be invited, and I just hope that more people that are listening in step up and become a host and reach out to us and find out more about the program.
And again, the link is on our AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Coming up, we'll talk about privacy concerns involving personal health and activity through apps designed to track menstrual cycles. That to come after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. Earlier this year, the Wall Street Journal reported the popular menstrual tracking app Flow had been sharing users' personal health info with Facebook. The company made changes. Now the UK-based advocacy group Privacy International claims multiple apps similar to Flow are doing the same thing. BuzzFeed News was first to report on this. With us is the lead researcher on the report for Privacy International, Eva Bloom-Gemonte. Thank you very much for joining us. Share with us how many of these apps you found was sharing this information, allowing Facebook to do targeted advertising.
Yeah, so essentially what happened was the apps we've looked at, which included Maya by Placatech and Mia by Mobapp Unlimited, were sharing very detailed descriptions to Facebook of people's sexual lives and their medical data as well. So while it's unclear if Facebook is eventually using it for advertisement, the very fact that they're sharing this data with Facebook is obviously very problematic.
How does the sharing take place? Is there something embedded in the app, or is it a separate step that the app companies are making? How does it make its way to Facebook?
Actually, what happens is that app developers are relying on a tool called the Facebook SDK. And it's essentially a tool that helps app developers manage the data they receive, that helps, you know, for example, companies to get statistics about their users. So it is a deliberate choice that that app owners make when they are developing their own apps to rely on this tool. And so it's through the use of this tool that's designed by Facebook that the sharing happens, because obviously then Facebook becomes the company that manages the data and that gets access to this data.
So the companies are not compensated by Facebook, but they are being provided something of value in exchange for that data being accessible by Facebook.
That's exactly right.
All right. And what is some of the personal and health information that's potentially available to Facebook?
Well, so this is where it's very concerning, right? Because it's very granular. Because when we're talking about menstruation apps, actually what's interesting is that they're not the questions they ask you and the data they collect is not strictly limited to menstruations per se. They will ask you about your sexual life, when the date of your sexual intercourse, whether it was protected sex or not. They ask about, you know, lifestyle questions like how much coffee do you drink? Do you drink cigarettes? They ask about your medications, your health, and obviously your contraception, so your birth control pills maybe. We even have one of the apps we look at that was even asking questions about masturbation, for example. And all of this information is then shared with Facebook and other third parties, which is obviously very concerning.
We reached out to Facebook and they declined our request for an interview, but provided a statement from Facebook spokesman Joe Osborne. It reads, contrary to BuzzFeed's reporting, our terms of service prohibit developers from sending us sensitive health information, and we enforce against them when we learn they are. In addition, ad targeting based on people's interests does not leverage information gleaned from people's activity across other apps or websites. Again, that's Facebook's statement provided to us from spokesman Joe Osborne. Eva, you want to respond to that statement?
Yeah, so that's actually an interesting statement, because we had a similar reaction from one of the third party we contacted, which is a company called AppsFlyer. And what AppsFlyer said is that they prohibit their customers from sharing health data with them, because especially in Europe, considering the data protection laws in Europe, medical data is considered sensitive personal data. And so you need a very high standard to handle this data. You need to uphold a high standard when it comes to the security and when it comes to the way you would handle this data. So most companies like Facebook or like AppsFlyer absolutely want you to stay away from medical data, because it's literally a legal nightmare for them. Now, that doesn't mean that those apps, those companies aren't sending them this health data. It's not that they ask for it, but this is how the sharing happens. Those apps are sharing data with them. Now, they can't obviously be analyzing every single bit of data that they receive. And so this is how they end up sometimes, without even knowing it, with health data, with sensitive data on their servers. But we would argue that, when companies like Facebook or like AppsFlyer decide to work with menstruation apps, I mean, they really should know better. It's very clear that, those apps are there to collect medical data. So for Facebook to then turn around and say, we don't do health data, we don't receive this kind of like sensitive data, that's obviously ludicrous.
Maya, which is another one of the app companies, weren't able to join us for an interview, but they provided us with this statement. Maya does not sell data to Facebook or any third party. We have in the past used tools from Facebook strictly to improve our product experience. We have proactively removed these tools from all versions of the app due to concerns about privacy. All data accessed by Maya are essential for the proper functioning of the product. Predicting information pertaining to menstrual cycles is complex and dependent on thousands of variables. Our users are made aware of our terms and conditions and privacy policy prior to signing up on Maya. Post sign up, our users can export their data and delete their account whenever they choose to. Maya is on a mission to build products that make a positive impact in the lives of women. We take pride in the trust our users put in us and follow best practices on data privacy. Eva Bloom, Jamonte, your response to Maya's statement.
Well, so first of all, I think there's a very important section in the statement that we are extremely pleased about, is that from now on, they will not be using the Facebook SDK anymore. They have removed it. So as far as we're concerned, this is a huge success for us. This is exactly the sort of results and the sort of outcome we were hoping for. We want to see companies changing their practices. It's not about telling users to stop using those apps. You know, if those apps are useful and beneficial for the people who use them, you know, people should feel empowered. They should feel free to use them. But we want companies to be much more mindful and respectful of the privacy of their users. And when companies respond this way, by changing their practices, by deciding not to use the Facebook SDK anymore, this is a step in the right direction. This is exactly what we want to see. So that's very positive.
Eva Bloom, Jamonte, thank you very much for being with us and talking about Privacy International's report, which just came out yesterday.
Thank you.
She's research officer with the UK-based group Privacy International. We'll continue our conversation. We have two additional guests to talk about concerns over personal data, health issues, activity that might be shared with Facebook via the particular tools provided by Facebook to apps which track menstrual cycle. We'll be back in just 1 minute on Air Talk. Good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up next hour, we'll take a look at the vaccine exemption bill signed yesterday by Governor Gavin Newsom. There were protesters at the state capitol building in Sacramento who were arrested as a result of that tremendous division over the bill. We're going to talk about what's actually in it coming up next hour. But right now, we're talking about privacy concerns over several apps which track menstrual cycle. They enable the women to use them to be able to track, better understand how their cycle's working. They feed different information into the app. The concerns are that Facebook potentially has access to some of that highly personal information that is entered into the app. Also with us to provide a perspective is Stacey Gray, senior counsel with the nonprofit think tank Future of Privacy Forum. Ms. Gray, thank you for being with us.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for having me on.
So what's your sense of how the industry is trying to fend off these concerns over privacy?
It's a good question because privacy is certainly having a moment right now, right? All kinds of apps use third parties like this for all kinds of purposes. A lot of it's very sensitive, like what we've been describing. And some of those apps belong to large established companies, but many of them are small companies, individual people, individual app developers, right, who aren't necessarily familiar with all of the obligations and the things they should be doing to protect this kind of information. They go in and install a Facebook SDK, for example, into their app without maybe thinking too much about it. And I think that's probably the biggest concern is how many apps are in the ecosystem and what kind of auditing and checking we should be doing on them, not just by Facebook, but the app stores as well.
Does HIPAA, the federal privacy regulations for health information, at all apply here? Or because this isn't a doctor-patient relationship, is it not relevant?
That's right. It doesn't apply, which is it really highlights the reason that we are pushing in Washington, D.C. for a comprehensive national data privacy law, because the same exact kind of data, equally sensitive about health information, when it's collected by a doctor, it's governed by a very strict United States federal privacy law, HIPAA. But the same exact kind of information, if it's collected by a mobile app or by your Fitbit, totally not regulated at all in the same way.
What about the terms of use? So often people don't bother to look at that. And even if they do, it's so long, so complicated. Most people just aren't going to sit with it and spend the time necessary to figure out what all is being shared. Is there a way, particularly those that are gathering sensitive health or personal behavior information, that this could be more clearly spelled out?
You're exactly right, and I think that's one of the things that within industry has been a standard for a long time, you know, that if you write it into a privacy policy that in theory people are reading them and making good choices about the kinds of apps that they download. And there's still some of that. I think people should be informed about the kinds of apps that they download. But there's this increasing recognition that with all of the online services we use day to day, in order to just even just read all of the privacy policies that apply would take such an insurmountable amount of time that I think there's this growing recognition that we can't and shouldn't rely on that as the source of our privacy protections. So there's a move towards finding ways within legal regulations to make sure that the companies are more responsible with the data they collect and how they use it and how they share it, rather than putting all of the onus on the person to make the right decision and read all of the privacy policies.
Does the Federal Trade Commission have any sort of jurisdiction here? Could they take any action against apps that don't have clear, easily understandable privacy policies?
They do. It's relatively limited. The FTC mostly has the power to stop companies from doing things that violate the law, and the law is against unfair or deceptive practices. And usually what that means in practice is if a company says something in their privacy policy or doesn't say something in their privacy policy that is very relevant and then does something different or leaves out something material, that they can have an enforcement action brought against them by the FTC. One of the things that there's really broad consensus about in Washington, D.C. right now is that the FTC should have more of an ability to bring civil penalties to fine companies when they violate the law in the first instance. Right now, you have to violate the law and be under an FTC consent decree, and then if you violate that, you can have major penalties brought against you. But there's a pretty big consensus that the FTC should be able to do more.
This isn't a legal question, so I'm not sure if I'm asking you something sort of fair in terms of your knowledge base. But there's this Facebook software development kit, SDK, that we were talking about with Eva earlier. Are there other ways of getting the kind of analytics and tracking that the apps can use which don't make this information available to the provider of the development kit?
It's a great question, because there are so many SDK providers out there, not just Facebook, but many other service providers that provide SDKs, maybe for free, maybe they're easily available, and then retain the right to use that data in future or other ways. So there are other models available. You can do the kind of analytics that you're trying to do yourself. You could contract it out to a service provider and share the data under, you know, a strict contract, for example, or a strict data use agreement. So there are other models out there. Often, I mean, my experience has been app developers, when they use the Facebook SDK, often it's because they want to manage their own data and they want to reach either new customers for their new apps or find new customers for their existing apps, or reach their own customers on Facebook. So it tends to be less of an issue of Facebook using the data to retarget ads as the app developer wants to retarget ads on Facebook, right? And so there are analogous providers for all kinds of different other similar social media.
Stacey, thanks for being with us. We appreciate it very much.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Stacey Gray, Senior Counsel with the Future of Privacy Forum, a nonprofit think tank based in D.C. Also with us from Indiana University School of Law, Professor Fred Cate, Senior Fellow at the Center for Applied Cybersecurity Research. Professor Cate, thank you for joining us. Your thoughts on how to avoid in the future this kind of what sounds like it's sort of unintentional sharing, but still, you know, cause for concern?
Well, it's a really hard set of questions that you've been asking, because on the one hand, you know, we live lives that are rich in data on social media, on these mobile devices we carry, on the sensors that surround us in our cars and home and workplace. And on the other hand, we sort of have a privacy system that's still sort of based on the fiction that individuals will make these decisions. So we have privacy notices that nobody reads and decisions that very few people make. And then when something bad happens, we say, well, you know, you agreed to that. And so it seems like what we're ultimately going to have to move to is more of a regulatory system that sets out permitted uses, unpermitted uses, and those situations in which consumers have to be told really clearly, you know, the pop-up box that says, we are collecting your data, may we, yes or no. There is a downside to this, though.
I was just going to ask you, yeah. So what's the trade-off in stuff that we enjoy and use?
Well, that's exactly it. A lot of people like the personalization. A lot of people would rather see ads for things they may be interested in than random ads. And almost everybody would prefer to get these services for free rather than have to pay for them. So we pay through sharing our data that's used for more targeted advertising. And so we're gonna have to recognize, and we've seen this in other countries that have more rigorous privacy protections, there will be costs to this type of privacy. I think it's worth it, but we need to be frank with the public about what those costs are likely to be.
And what's your sense? I wonder if anybody's ever surveyed the public. You know, if you were explicitly asked for your permission, let's say it's a woman using one of these menstrual cycle apps to keep track of the cycle and birth control and other things. And if the user is asked, do you give us permission as part of using the app to share this information with third parties, how many women would use it?
Well, one of the things we know, and it's not distinctive to this situation, but in many situations, no matter what you tell people, if you tell them they can't have the thing for free or they can't get the discount, if they don't allow their information to be used, they agree to let their information be used. And just think about a visit to any grocery store where you can get, you know, 50 cents off a drink by sharing your personal information, by using a frequent shopper card. Very few people say, no, I'm not going to take advantage of that because I don't want to share my data.
Yeah, because the savings are so big, few people would do that trade-off.
It's exactly right. And this is especially true in the online environment where we use search engines that we don't pay for. We use browsers that we don't pay for. We use apps that we don't pay for. At least we don't pay for them directly because they use data to make money in other ways, usually through advertising. And so it may very well be we need to make those trade-offs much clearer, but we need to be aware there's still going to be trade-offs.
And if you're correct that most people are going to say, well, I'd rather have it for free, I'll give up my data, then there wouldn't appear to be as big a downside to the app companies in making very clear, easily understood privacy policies in terms of use. And sounds like most people would say, yeah, I'll check off on that. I want to be able to use the app for free.
I think that's right. I think the challenge of coming back to the individual, though, is because we so quickly and so easily check the box and say, yes, as long as I can get this for free, I'm going to go ahead and agree. But then we have no idea what's really done with our data. And as we see time and time again involving these large companies, they often don't know exactly what's done with the data either. And so, you know, part of the challenge is not just giving users control, but more importantly, ensuring that somebody's in control of what data are collected and how they're used.
Fred Kay, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it. We'll be back in the second hour of Air Talk momentarily. Our music is back. Good morning. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We just had a few minutes there. We had no ability to play music. Our system totally went down. I felt so unprotected out in the broadcast world without our music. And Michelle Faust-Raghavan, we were going to have her sing our way into the segment. But Michelle, you got a reprieve. So
yeah, you know, I'd love to do it, but I don't have any songs that are healthcare appropriate.
We'll find some kids' songs about going to the doctor or something like that. Coming up later this hour, we're going to take a look at a bill that passed in Sacramento, figuratively sitting on the governor's desk, that would allow athletes at NCAA schools to be able to profit from the use of their name or likeness. That runs afoul of NCAA national rules. We'll talk about the potential for a legal battle there. But first, we turn our attention to the bill that has been signed by Governor Newsom, controversial bill which restricts the exemptions provided to parents for their kids' childhood vaccinations. The governor had asked for some changes in the bill. He got a number of changes to it, and with us to talk about it, the aforementioned healthcare reporter, KPCC, Michelle Faust Raghavan. So, Michelle, we talked just a couple days ago about what the governor wants changed. Did he get all those?
He got his wishes, for sure. And the way that they did it was something that I think a lot of people aren't fully familiar with. They took another bill that was already in motion and deleted some bits and added everything the governor wanted. And it's all here. And it does make some changes
this
to the
original bill.
This gut
and amend thing is the weirdest thing in Sacramento, how you take the sausage case, remove all the contents, and make a new sausage out of it.
Yeah, it's something that, you know, I'm still trying to wrap my head around. But yeah, so basically, the bill does generally what it was already planning on doing. It gives the Department of Public Health this opportunity to scrutinize and potentially revoke some medical exemptions. But medical exemptions are the only way that kids can go to public schools in California if they're not fully vaccinated. And so it does give that scrutiny to the Department of Public Health. But the changes that were made really are just more on the dates. So that increased scrutiny starts January 1st of the coming year. There's also some words in the new bill and the amendments to that bill that make it so they won't go back in time and look at existing medical exemptions. Kids who have medical exemptions will keep them unless they have a doctor who's in trouble otherwise with the medical board.
All right. So one of the concerns I know was that, and I think you mentioned this example, children's hospitals where a child's being treated, those docs may write quite a few exemptions because of their patient load. Are they factored into this, considered differently than a doc in private practice who's writing a lot of exemptions?
No, any doctor that's doing more than five medical exemptions, there'll be some extra scrutiny onto the exemptions that they're writing. But a childhood cancer specialist, they're going to write a lot of them for childhood cancers. The Department of Public Health is aware of kids who are in certain types of treatments, that it's not a good idea for them to be adding vaccines to the other things that they're doing, that it may not work for them. They may have a bad reaction, or it just may not work.
So they'll be looked at, but presumably the state will say, well, this makes sense. This is not a red flag that you've got a physician who's indiscriminately handing out exemptions.
Right. I mean, they'll still be scrutinized, but I imagine that scrutiny, that process will be much quicker.
If you have questions for Michelle, you can ask them by calling. They'll be passed on to us at 866-893-5722, or you can post your questions on the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. This was such a volatile issue in Sacramento. I mentioned that there were arrests yesterday. Are any of the opponents of this bill threatening legal action, or do you have any sense of where they turn now?
Well, the signatures just came down yesterday. So in terms of legal action, you know, that's yet to come. But, you know, it possibly could happen. People have sent me some emails saying that opponents to the bill were sending emails saying that they were concerned about people being able to get exemptions for their children, kids who might have had some sort of anaphylaxis. But of course, your doctors are going to be looking at, you know, if a child has a certain type of allergy, whether that allergy would be likely to react to some of the components of a vaccine. But they wouldn't necessarily write it just because a child had anaphylaxis related to something else.
And also, I couldn't recall, Michelle, is it still a part of the bill that schools with less than, 95% vaccination rates would get added scrutiny?
That's right. So basically, every school has to, every once in a while in California, this is already the law, they have to submit their vaccination rates, and that's looked at, you know, for tracking purposes. But now they're not going to be able to do it in less than a year. Like, it has to happen at least a year, every year, if not more frequently, that they have to submit that, and that'll be looked at. So that 95%, that that is what they call the herd or the community immunity. That's to kind of protect everyone, the kids with childhood cancers and all of the other types of illnesses that might make it not a good idea that they do get vaccinated. That protects them if everyone else around them is vaccinated. So that 95% is kind of that key thing that public health researchers want. And so if school has less than 95%, then they're going to give that some extra scrutiny and potentially be looking at the doctors that are writing the medical exemptions for those kids in that school.
Michelle, very good. I want you to say, though, five times really fast, community immunity, community.
It's quite hard.
that's a real tongue twister. Michelle, thanks very much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And we'll look forward to seeing her continuing coverage of this at LAist.com and, of course, on air right here on 89.3 KPCC. Michelle Faust, Raghavan, KPCC healthcare reporter. Coming up, we're going to be taking a look at the NCAA versus the state of California over new legislation that passed both houses of the legislature yesterday. The state legislature has passed a bill that would let college athletes, hire agents, be paid for the use of their name, image, or likeness. The final vote in the state Senate would be on Friday, but we look at what this bill might mean for college athletics here in California. Question is the NCAA so incensed about this that they might actually take action against their California member schools? Joining us to talk about the bill, Executive Director of the National College Players Association, a nonprofit that was launched by UCLA football players, Ramogi Huma. Mr. Huma, thank you for being with us. First of all, are there concerns about this bill being able to legally stand?
No, not at all. We're proud to be co-sponsors of the bill. This bill is going to protect college athletes and ensure them equal rights and freedoms. If you look at other students on campus, if you look at other California residents, other American citizens, no one has these kinds of prohibitions on whether or not they can earn money on their name, image, and likeness. The NCAA has threatened essentially what would be an illegal group boycott, saying the California colleges may be banned from NCAA championships. However, and I've been an advisor on the major antitrust lawsuits over the last several years against the NCAA, and the NCAA was ruled multiple times to not have the power to do things like that, to act like a monopolistic cartel. To have that power, you have to have an exemption from Congress. The NCAA never was granted that power by Congress. So if the NCAA were to attempt to initiate a group boycott against California colleges over this, not only would the NCAA be in violation of federal antitrust law, they'd be in violation of state California antitrust law. So it's really an empty threat. And the state of California, as you can tell, the lawmakers, yesterday the assembly passed the bill 72-0. 72-0. The lawmakers are not bowing down to the NCAA's threats. They're doing the right thing.
We're talking with Ramogi Huma, who is the executive director of the National College Players Association. We have a statement from the Pac-12 conference in response to the bill. The NCAA has formed a working group that is looking into the matter of student-athlete name, image, and likeness, and this group is expected to complete its work this fall. Our view is the most prudent course is for the California legislature to hold further action on its Fair Pay to Play Act pending the outcome of the NCAA's work, which we believe will be very informative to this discussion. We all want to protect and support our student-athletes, and the Pac-12 has played a leadership role in national reforms for student-athletes over the past years. The question is, what's the best way to continue to support our student-athletes? We think having more information and informed views will be helpful. Also with us is the Director of Athletics at Cal State Long Beach, which is an NCAA Division I member, Andy Fee. Mr. Fee, thank you for being with us. If this ends up being signed into law by the governor, what sort of effect do you think this would have on member schools like yours?
Well, I think there's a couple concerns, Larry. And, you know, there's the old adage about measuring twice and cutting once. One issue is, you know, what kind of restrictions or parameters would be around those name, image, likeness deals. For example, could you have a football quarterback signing an agreement with MGM Grand Casino and Sportsbook, which is would be wagering on college sports and also playing in the football game on Saturday. So that would be a concern. And then secondly, which I think the legislation doesn't address, are international students. So international students who are here on an F1 student visa, there's pretty strict federal regulations around employment. And the type of employment around name, image, likeness would be in violation of that. And potentially you could have student athletes being deported. So I think there's a lot of nuance to this. And, you know, from a position standpoint of my view, I think it's a great conversation. I think it's one that we want to have. We want to always improve the student athlete experience. But I think we want to do it in a thoughtful way and not rush. So, you know, I would urge some caution here.
I also wonder about the types of marketing or advertising that might be products that the university wouldn't want to necessarily be associated with. An example might be recreational cannabis, adult-oriented websites. I mean, there are things where having the athlete making money from it could reputationally be an issue for the college or university. What are your thoughts about the ability under this bill for the colleges to restrict that?
Yeah, and Larry, that's a great question, and one I think, again, that requires more thought. As you mentioned, cannabis is legal in the state of California. However, it is a prohibited substance by the NCAA. You know, I believe in Long Beach, I think there's over 20 marijuana dispensaries. And I think there is some question about the association related between student athletes and the university itself. While a student athlete may want to represent a certain line of business, the university itself may have some questions and concerns. So, again, I think it's, you know, there's a lot of nuance to this. For sure, Larry.
Mr. Huma, would the universities have any control under this bill of the types of products that its athletes could be associated with?
Yeah, there's been a number of amendments because of the opposition's concerns. The schools and the NCAA are opposed, and Senator Skinner has taken some of the amendments to alleviate those concerns. For instance, if USC has a Nike deal and there's a player who Under Armour wants to sponsor, Under Armour, that player would not be able to wear Under Armour shoes during the game. After the game, they can wear them all they want. So there has been an amendment to actually look at that. And I think, too, you know, again, this is about equal rights. And I think big picture here, this is about civil rights. Okay, first of all, the majority of California athletes are from protected classes, minorities, women. And they are treated without the same regard as regular students. You're talking about whether or not a regular student, let's have a conversation about whether a regular student would be restricted by various types of activities that a school didn't approve of. If they're illegal, they're illegal, okay? And if someone's going to throw a game, that's illegal. That's already covered. We don't need ADs in the colleges, you know, fretting about that. There's laws against that, okay?
But a typical student isn't really representing his or her school in the way that an athlete is representing her or his team or athletic organization. Is it really the same?
Well, it's actually very similar in that on their own time, they're human beings, they're full human beings with equal rights. Just because you are a college athlete does not mean you should be forced to forfeit equal rights as a condition of playing college sports.
But if you're a coach, for example, you're under contract to a university, you likely have limitations in your contract about outside income that deal reputationally, otherwise, with concerns the employer had. In this case, would the student athlete have any of those sorts of contractual restraints?
So the coaches have agents to negotiate that. So whatever they give up, they can negotiate something additionally for. This bill actually also provides the ability for college athletes to secure agents to do the same thing. So if a school wants to restrict players from various types of things it doesn't want to be associated with, that should be a negotiation, not a mandate from a cartel that's based in Indiana. This should be a part of the free market that the schools can actually enter into. and deal with players as equals, not as some piece of property. So I think this bill is largely recognized as a free enterprise and civil rights bill, which is why you get bipartisan support and you get a vote 72-0. The colleges and the schools have been, and the NCAA have been bad actors. They have denied players equal rights. Right. And it's great to see California stepping in and righting that wrong.
We're talking with the executive director of the National College Players Association, Ramogi Huma, also with us, Andy Fee, director of athletics at Cal State University, Long Beach, talking with us about the bill, which is due to be voted on in the state Senate on Friday. We'll continue our conversation. We'll take your calls at 866-893-KPECC. Back in 1 minute. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. We're talking about a bill that's passed the state assembly, headed to the state Senate, that would allow athletes at California colleges and universities to be able to hire agents and to be able to make money from the use of their image, endorsements, their name. Those rights would be held by the player. The NCAA is opposed to the bill. This is in violation of their national policies. The question is, if the bill passes the full legislature and is signed by the governor, what happens next? We're talking with the athletic director of Cal State Long Beach, home of the back-to-back national champions in men's volleyball, as well as other teams competing in the Big West, Andy Fee, and Ramogi Huma, who is executive director of the National College Players Association, a group which started with UCLA football players. It advocates for college athletes nationwide. Mr. Huma also played for UCLA. If you have questions for our guests about the bill, we're at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. The listener asks a question, Ramogi, about non-athletes, but who are sort of de facto members of the athletic department, like cheerleaders, the song team at USC, for example. Would their members be covered by this, or are they already free to sell their image and likeness?
From what I understand, they're already free.
Okay, so this wouldn't have an effect on them. Andy Fee, do you know, as a practical matter, has anyone ever tried, Cal State Long Beach to hire any of the members of your support teams like that, cheer teams or cheerleaders, to use in ads?
We have not to my knowledge, Larry.
Okay, because again, you're sort of leveraging the university potentially in doing that. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Andy, do you think it's possible that the NCAA, out of concerns over the precedent, would go so far as to ban California colleges and universities from tournament play?
Larry, I think it's possible. I can't say with certainty whether that would or wouldn't happen. But what I can tell you is, an analogy I've used is that, we all sit down to play Monopoly. And suddenly I pull out a separate rule book that says, when I pass go, I get $400 to your $200. I can't imagine many people who would want to continue to play Monopoly with me under that set of circumstances. If you have a set of schools that have student athletes receiving compensation, I can't imagine, for example, Texas, Ohio State, Notre Dame, any of those schools being okay that the four BCS football programs in California would have essentially paid athletes on their rosters. I just don't see it. It's a practical standpoint of fair competition from their standpoint. I can't imagine that they would want to go against a stacked deck, so to speak. So I think there would be significant pushback from a scheduling standpoint. Initially, you could see series being canceled or future games not being scheduled on the books.
As I mentioned, Cal State Long Beach, part of the Big West, not the Pac-12, but the Pac-12 has this committee it's set up to look into these issues. Do you have any sense that whether it's one of the Big Five power conferences or the NCAA as a whole, that they're going to take further steps to give athletes the ability to profit at all independently during their college years?
You know, that's you know, a little bit out of my realm to speak on behalf of the NCAA as a whole. What I can tell you from my position as the athletic director, we're always looking to improve the student athlete experience. That's why we do what we do as coaches and administrators. We want to see our student athletes graduate with a great degree and go on and be a significant member of their community or a professional athlete, wherever that leads them. I do think that this gets down to the significance of what is an amateur and what is it to be a professional. You know, I look at it and I think to myself, there are other avenues. If money is what the issue is about, you can become a professional athlete. For example, Tiger Woods, he could have turned professional and joined the PGA Tour out of high school. But he chose to go to Stanford, I believe, for 2 years, and then he turned to professional. But there's no requirement that you have to come to the NCAA to participate in sports. You see many baseball athletes out of high school who sign Major League Baseball deals, who are drafted right out of high school and choose to become professionals.
There are
other avenues.
Yeah, but it's tough in basketball, football. You have to admit that, you know, in football, playing college ball seems to be a de facto requirement. In basketball, you know, unless you're a LeBron James, Kobe Bryant, someone who's going to jump straight from high school, that can be difficult. You have to line up playing abroad, somehow get attention playing in Europe or elsewhere to take an alternate route. But Andy Fee, I appreciate it. Athletic Director, Cal State Long Beach. Ramogi Huma, quick response to the point that was made by Andy Fee about, you know, there are other alternatives. You're not obligated to take the scholarship and go to an NCAA member school.
That's completely false. The NCAA has a monopoly, college sports nationwide, and the vast majority of players are completely equipped and able to play college sports, but less than 2% step foot in the pros. So it's not like there's some option to go pro for everybody. And the fact is, you've worked hard all your life. You enter a $14 billion a year industry that flaunts money and coaches get endorsements, and you're forced to wear university sponsored logos all over your jerseys. You see the money flowing. That's a double standard of monopoly. Everybody else gets to cash in, but you don't. And that's what this bill is about. It's about standing up to that double standard, the hypocrisy, and granting players equal rights.
Ramogi Huma, thank you for being with us. He's executive director of the National College Players Association, nonprofit launched by UCLA football players. And Mr. Huma is an alum of UCLA Bruin team. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up, we're going to take a look at the choice to get off of antidepressants and the challenges that await. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Los Angeles Times columnist David Lazarus has been writing a series about his own personal efforts to get off of an antidepressant. He decided to do so after reading a New York Times piece about how challenging it can be for those who want to taper off of antidepressants they're using to do so. In the case of David, he was taking an antidepressant to help him get to sleep because of his type 1 diabetes and the difficulty he was having falling asleep at night. After using an antidepressant for an extended period of time, he decided he wanted to get off it and was describing the challenge, even with a long tapering off period, in doing so. Joining us to talk about that challenge and why it can be so difficult is Dr. Steven Siegel, chair of the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at the USC Keck School of Medicine, who was just with us very recently. Dr. Siegel, good to have you back with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on the show.
How do you prepare your patients who might be wanting to move off of antidepressants, if you think it's safe for them to do so, for the range of challenge that can present, given that, you know, everybody has their own individual response?
So I think you're hitting an appropriate issue, which is that people have different responses, and all we can do is share the various risks as percentages of a population. So we can talk about the likelihood of relapse. We can talk about the likelihood of experiencing some of the discontinuation symptoms. But most importantly, I think it's helpful to describe that they're not in this alone, and that as we embark on that process, no decision is irreversible, and we can always respond appropriately to any issues they're having.
One of the top of mind concerns would be, you know, the reason that someone is taking an antidepressant, and if they're doing it because of suicidal thoughts, serious threat of self-harm, deep chronic depression. I mean, cases like that, you have to be very, very concerned that you're going to do more harm than good in getting off it. So what are some of the things you raise with your patients about whether it's even safe to consider going off an antidepressant?
So first, history is an important harbinger of risk. So I prepared for this segment by trying to go back and read how much of what I believe I know could I find support for in literature. And what we believe we know, and I think is supported, is that if it's a first episode of depression, the literature would suggest that you should stay on antidepressants for over a year, and that not doing so puts you at a dramatic increase of risk for relapse. If it's your second episode, then you would anticipate you would need to stay on even longer, maybe a year and a half, to create a safe space for you to begin discontinuation. And after a third episode, meaning that you've been successfully treated for depression, came off antidepressants, and it came back, after that, the likelihood that you will not have a relapse is very small, and it would be most prudent to remain on antidepressants as a prophylactic treatment for the foreseeable future.
For someone you determine that it would appear they can safely come off of an antidepressant, is the length of the period of decreasing dosage related to how long that they've been taking it?
It's more not that I'm aware of. So it's not that if you've been on for a year, we need 2 months, but if you've been on for 6 months, we can quicker. I don't know of any data that supports that. Alternatively, one can reduce some of the uncomfortable aspects, the physical responses to discontinuing a medicine by tapering slowly.
All right. We're going to open up our phone lines. You can join us at 866-893-KPECC. We're talking about the decision to go off of an antidepressant, the potential risks that are involved, the different diagnoses which lead someone to go onto an antidepressant, how that factors in, the number of times someone has gone on or off an antidepressant. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Back after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. Such pleasure to have you with us. Fresh Air with Terry Gross coming up at noon. Jody Cantor and Megan Toohey, authors of She Said, their new book about Harvey Weinstein. They're going to be joining Terry coming up at noon right here on 89.3. You've probably seen, if you're someone who takes antidepressants, and millions of Americans do, some of the concerns about long-term use of antidepressants. Like anything else, you have to consider the risks of taking versus the risks of not taking for people who have, you know, serious depression. that they're dealing with. But David Lazarus, in a series of personal columns that he's writing in the LA Times, describing his challenge with weaning himself off of an antidepressant he's been taking for a number of years now. So he thought it'd be good to open up the phones, hear from listeners. If you're someone who is trying or did try to get off antidepressants or successfully did it, to talk about the challenges involved, the importance of monitoring, of course, working with a medical professional on this. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Dr. Steven Siegel, USC's Keck School of Medicine, with us, where he chairs the Department of Psychiatry. Professor Siegel, how do you talk with your patients about the potential risks of long-term antidepressant usage versus the risks of not using an antidepressant?
Well, it's in the context of the reason that they're taking it, as you alluded to, and their tolerance for the side effects of the medications or the effects of the medication, and I'll be clear about that in one moment, versus the effects of not taking it. So, for example, we know there are all sorts of side effects to antidepressants, ranging from sexual dysfunction to a flattening of people's experience, meaning they no longer experience the highs or the lows. So the world gets a bit gray. And they sometimes will find those as disturbing as the reason they're taking the medicine. So it's a risk-benefit analysis of the extent to which the primary symptoms are distressing or risky versus your ability to live a full and happy life with the effects of the medicine.
We're at 866-893-KPECC. Jane, in Monterey Park, you're on Air Talk. Were you able to wean yourself off of an antidepressant?
It took me over a year, and that is after I had to beg my psychiatrist to give me compound prescriptions to be able to do it. They didn't believe me. My psychiatrist thought I was having getting depressed again, having the, but they did not believe me about the withdrawal symptom.
So your doctor chalked up what you were experiencing to the reemergence of depression.
Exactly. He told me 2 weeks. I actually took about three because I thought 2 weeks was too quick. And I had a full blown another major depressive with panic and attack, severe anxiety. And it took me about a year going, little by little by little. And I have been 3 years without any sort of medication.
All right. That's great, Jane. Thank you. But it was a chat. Did you feel well supported going through it? It sounds like your experience with your doctor made it more challenging for you.
Oh, yes, it was. I felt I was insane. They didn't believe me. It did feel like I even had one doctor say, I think you're being paranoid that it was the drug.
Jane, I appreciate your call. Dr. Steven Siegel, how challenging is it for doctors to differentiate between the reemergence of depression and the physical effects of going off the antidepressant that Jane's describing?
Well, I think it can be a challenge. I think the patient's experience is the patient's experience. There's no questioning what they're experiencing and that they're having difficulty. The part that's harder is the attribution of the cause of that. Now, there are some known effects of discontinuing antidepressants, and they're flu-like symptoms, GI upset, sleep disturbances. And you can see how changes in appetite, changes in sleep, might be overlapping with the reemergence of depression, whereas the flu-like symptoms, again, things like being achy, might or might not overlap. And so it is difficult to ascribe attribution. It is not difficult to acknowledge that the patient is having that experience.
Is there any way to to determine in advance the likelihood? I mean, you mentioned first, second, or, you know, third time that people have been on an antidepressant, but beyond that, to determine someone being prone to relapse in depression versus someone who it seems that neurologically there's been enough of a shift while on antidepressants that they're less vulnerable to depressive episodes?
To the best of my knowledge, the predictors of relapse are very similar to the predictors of depressive episodes. Those include support systems, family history, life stressors, and additional factors that predispose people towards depression. And the more of those risk factors someone has, the more likely they are to have a depressive episode and a relapse, is my impression.
What about if you have someone not just taking the SSRIs, the more common antidepressants, but maybe they're using benzos, at the same time, anti-anxiety medication? Does that make it more complicated to come off the antidepressant, or do patients often try and come off them at the same time?
So I don't recommend doing more than one thing at a time or doing anything very quickly. I think it precludes your ability to understand what's happening and ascribe the cause. So all of these medicines, whether it be an SSRI or a benzodiazepine or any other of the antidepressant type medications, cause long-term adaptations in your innate biology. You change your neurotransmitter systems. That's why perhaps it takes 2 to 3 months to see an effect. And conversely, as you come off of these medicines, your brain, your body need to adapt back. And if you make quick changes, you don't give your body chances to adapt. And if you do more than one thing at a time, you don't know which of those led to the difficulty you're experiencing. So I think that these processes require time courses that recognize you've adapted to the medicine, you need to adapt back. It took a long time for your biology to change. It's going to take a long time for it to adapt back.
We're talking with Dr. Steven Siegel. He chairs the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at the USC Keck School of Medicine. We're taking your calls. If you're someone who is contemplating or has gone through the experience of weaning yourself off of antidepressants, or anti-anxiety medication, what were some of the challenges and what helped you get through that experience? 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We'll be back in just 1 minute. Friend of AirTalk and LA Times columnist David Lazarus has been writing about his personal experiences of trying to wean himself off of an SSRI antidepressant that he was taking and successfully took to treat his insomnia that was a result of his type 1 diabetes. And David, talking about just how challenging it is to do that, the side effects as he's withdrawing from the effect of the SSRI. So we're opening up the phones. You had similar experiences to talk about it, some of the things that maybe helped you, or if it didn't, if you went off and it didn't work out well, also share your experience there too. 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Dr. Steven Siegel, USC Keck School of Medicine. We've had a number of listeners who called to say, you know, they had to get off for other reasons, I guess side effects or other things, to get off of an SSRI, and that it was really hell to go through getting off it, but that was, I guess, easier than dealing with the side effects of the drug. You have patients for whom that's their circumstance.
Yes. I mean, people are, I think, sharing a common experience that these are medicines, you know, and not to be trite, but they're medicines that have profound effects on human biology. And when they're withdrawn, that also has profound effects on human biology that people experience as distress.
Robin writes on the page, I worry that stories like this overshadow the real good, the improved lives, the saved lives that the medication provides for millions. Yes, people should know in some cases it's hard to get off the drug, but please let's not scare people off from taking medication that can make their lives much better. You have a very good point. It's just obviously this is something that people have to weigh, that there can be a challenge getting off the drug down the road. But obviously, it's had a huge impact on the psychological well-being and physical safety of people who have relied on these SSRIs. Dr. Siegel?
I think it's an incredibly important insight. Depression is a major source of suffering, a major source of mortality, and other reasons people take antidepressants of anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, these are all sources of incredible distress. And we should not lose sight of the fact that we have effective treatments, both pharmacologic and non-pharmacologic, to alleviate that suffering. So it's this incredibly important point that your listener makes.
Annie in Long Beach, you're on Air Talk.
I was diagnosed with severe bipolar disorder when I was young. There was a lot of abuse in my home when I was a kid, and I attempted suicide a number of times, and I was put on antidepressants, and it made me really flatline. I mean, I went totally blah, and there was no excitement in my life. I had two kids. I had no energy. So if in the meantime, I'd started doing different kinds of physical activity like ballet, yoga, gymnastics, some trapeze, a lot of crazy stuff. But at one point, I realized that I could handle my own depression by the endorphins I got from cycling, yoga, and that sort of thing. And I actually weaned myself of a number of depressants, and it took me more than once. But right now I'm in my 70s, and I'm one of the healthiest people I know and a lot of people I knew.
Congratulations. That's terrific that it worked well. And Dr. Siegel, I'm sure you hear all different sorts of personal stories about what works for an individual to be able to do this.
Indeed. And those themes, though, are just perfect, and I'm so glad you shared that message. There are many paths to success, many paths to happiness here, and exercise, finding engagement in a community, finding activities you enjoy, these are all contributory. Good nutrition, good sleep, etc. So they may not be sufficient for everyone at every time, but they are helpful as part of your armamentarium in helping battle depression.
Jim in Culver City wonders about the different effects of different types of antidepressants going off them. So is this typically customized for patients based on the particular drug that they're taking?
It should be. In the sense that we do have multiple classes. We have SSRIs, which are selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. We have classes of drugs that address both serotonin and norepinephrine, the so-called SNRIs. And then we have drugs that affect a broader array of neurotransmitter systems and therefore have a different profile of activity when being used, but also are perhaps going to have more repercussions in terms of coming off of them because you have multiple systems adapting. So we should be choosing our medications tailored to the patient's needs and likewise tailoring our discontinuation strategy based on the medication that we've been using.
There are groups available for people dealing with chronic depression and other psychological challenges. Are there any groups specifically aimed at people who are weaning themselves off antidepressants?
I'm not, so I don't know of one. Oh, that doesn't mean it doesn't exist.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful idea.
I was wondering if there are enough people at any given time to have a group of people do that.
So I will make a shameless ploy to say it's a great idea, and I'd love to institute that here, and I hope other people listening will also do so.
That's the kind of thing, I don't know how much this is done in psychiatric or psychological therapy, but even online meetups where people could talk about what's worked for them, their challenges, and have a sense they're not doing it alone. Because so often when people undertake what can be a difficult task, it helps to have others who are making the journey along with them.
And that can be very helpful. Obviously, this is not unique to mental health or depression. And the one cautionary note is to remember that other people's experiences are their experience. And if you are not having that experience, it doesn't mean there's something wrong with you. It doesn't mean that, that you can't handle it, so to speak. It's just everybody's experience is a bit unique. And while it's helpful to share, it's also helpful to remember that things that are not working for you doesn't make you defective. It just means that strategy worked for someone else. It may not work for you.
Seems like it's human nature. We want to compare ourselves against others and make a moral judgment based on that, which certainly isn't helpful here. Dr. Siegel, thank you very much. Really appreciate your giving us this extended time to talk about this important topic.
Thank you for addressing this important topic, and thank you for having me on the show.
Dr. Steven Siegel chairs the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at USC Keck School of Medicine, where he is professor. Heidi in Long Beach says, I went off an antidepressant 10 years ago to get pregnant, and I experienced a brain buzz, a feeling that lasted 4 to 5 days. I felt off. I couldn't concentrate. I'm back on the medication now, though. That's Heidi in Long Beach. Have a terrific afternoon. Fresh Air with Terry Gross comes up next, and I sure look forward to talking with you tomorrow morning at 10 for the next Air Talk.